Welcome to Up on Foil, the podcast where we talk all about foiling. And today, episode number 43, it's with Daniela Moraz. And let me introduce us real quick. I'm Matt. I'm a former sailor, pretty average foiler and podcaster with a little YouTube channel. And you are a kiteboarder, a foiler. You're an Olympian. You're fourth at the last Olympic Games, a six times world champion and Rolex Yachtswoman of the Year. Is there anything, Daniela, you want to add?
No, that's pretty much it. I think you covered it.
And it's so exciting because you're the third Olympian we have on the show, but you're actually the best so far. So that is super exciting.
I'll take that.
And maybe we can just like give the listeners a little introduction how you got there. Like maybe did you start as a sailor? How did you got introduced into water sports?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and my parents were windsurfers actually. I grew up around windsurfing, and then my dad started kiting in like 2005. And then once I was kind of old enough to learn to either kite or windsurf, I wanted to learn to kite, of course, because that was the cooler thing. And at the time, I think I was like 11 or 12, I started learning to kite. And then I was very competitive growing up. I played a ton of different sports. Like I was a swimmer primarily, like all through middle school and high school, actually. But I like played water polo, I played tennis. So I was like doing a ton of different sports and I always had to be the best. So when I tried, well, I got the opportunity to try competing in racing, which was really popular in the Bay Area at the time. I mean, even now it is, racing is everything in the Bay Area. And my parents were also like racing in windsurfing. So I like kind of grew up around racing, and that was kind of the way to compete and like the form of competition that I was always exposed to. So I got the opportunity to try racing in the Bay Area and I just fell in love with it. I loved going fast and trying to beat all the old guys, little 12, 13 year old girl, just getting out there, getting after it. But yeah, I was just hooked right away and really loved it. And then I think like 1 year, this was still back on like the Formula course boards, like the three fin boards, we weren't foiling yet. And then pretty much the following year was when everybody started learning to foil. So I think I learned to foil the winter of like 2013, 2014. So I've been foiling for over 10 years now, which is really crazy.
That's super early as well.
Almost, yeah. And almost half my life at this point, which is super crazy. So it's just like, as soon as I learned to foil, I knew it was something I was meant to do and I just loved it. And then, yeah, I kept progressing in my racing and in my foiling, and eventually, yeah, was like traveling all around the world for that, managed to win a few world championships. And then eventually the sport went Olympic, kind of like by the end of 2018, we knew it was going to be in the 2024 Olympics. So that became my entire focus and my entire life, I would say. Got to go to Paris last summer, just missed out on a medal, which was really, really brutal. But I am now continuing, and I just moved down to LA to train for the LA 2028 Olympics. So yeah, so lots of exciting stuff ahead. And I've been very lucky, very, very grateful. And I've had so many cool opportunities along the way and met so many awesome people too. So it's been, I can't complain. It's been great.
Super cool. We're going to take this apart a little bit. And just if you see me wobbling around, I'm standing on a balance board. I'm trying to improve my balance. That's what I usually do while
working or podcasting. Nice. I love it.
If I fall, it's really no problem. I'm going to get back up. But so kiteboarding was your first sport on the water. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would say first.
Or did you windsurf before?
I windsurfed a little bit on like a tiny little sail and super floaty board on the like light wind days up in like the Sherman Island Delta, which is where I learned to kite. And then my parents would go, they would do like the U.S. Nationals, which were up in the Gorge and Hood River. So the light wind days, I would like go float around on my board, but I wouldn't say it was like proper windsurfing. But I like also surfed a little bit growing up, but then eventually, yeah, I feel like kiting was my big main exposure to like wind and water sports.
But you were still very, very little, and you probably had a small kite as well. And when I look back at that time, I used to be a windsurfer and always looked at kiters, and it felt a little weird. And I didn't like them too much because you never knew if they knew how to actually kite or not. So you're always a little bit scared and like taking your distance. But you must have been one of the first like kids kiting, or were there other kids around?
I mean, at least where I'm from, there were definitely not many kids around that were kiting. And oh my gosh, but I remember being like 5, 6 years old. And my dad was learning to kite, and I remember him coming out of the water and like completely wrapped in lines. And I was, and my mom and I saw him, and I was like, I am never doing that. And then sure enough, like 5, 6, 7 years later, it like got a lot safer and like the equipment improved. And then I saw there was a like instructor local in the Bay Area that was like teaching a lot of women to kite, and she would do it like in a really safe way. So I was like, okay, maybe like this is something like I would want to try. Now like the equipment has just gone above and beyond. And then now everyone's like winging, and there's a para wing now. So there's like all these other things. So it's been cool to see like how kiting and like kite racing and then kite foiling has evolved over all these years into kind of like all these other sports. But yeah, it's been super crazy.
And you said that you had some light wind spots, because I was in San Francisco, and I think it was 2005, something like that. And the conditions were super harsh. Obviously, a lot of wind, a lot of current, super cold water as well. Are there some areas then that are a little more suited to beginners?
Yeah, so Crissy Field, which is like the main spot in San Francisco where you can go like kite under the Golden Gate Bridge, probably one of the gnarliest places to like sail, kite, windsurf in the world for sure. Like it's super gnarly. It's super windy, super strong shipping. Well, super strong current, ton of shipping traffic. It's like super foggy sometimes. So there's like, you've got a lot on, and it's definitely not for the faint of heart. But I learned to kite up in the Delta, which is like a little bit inland, and it's, the wind is just a bit more like consistent there. The water is warmer, the air is warmer. And like flatter water, so all these things. So it's definitely more beginner friendly. It blows like nonstop there all summer. So it'll be 20, 25 knots, like from 9 a.m. all through the night. And like the sunrise sessions there are like sometimes the windiest sessions, which is super crazy. But yeah, so there's definitely like Northern California, there's quite a bit of wind like around the Bay Area. So yeah.
All right, very cool. And then you saw the foil and you got on foil. Can you remember how that was for you? Was that easy for you, as you are still super young? Or did you have to adjust and get like a couple of sessions in before you really got it?
I mean, it definitely took me a few sessions. And I remember, yeah, we were down in, we always go to Baja, like down to Los Barriles and La Ventana in the winter with my parents. My parents have been going there for 30 plus years now, I think, like even before there was a town down there. So they would always go for windsurfing. And then when they had me and we all started kiting, eventually we'd go for kiting. And so, yeah, I started learning to foil down there, which was quite intense actually, because Los Barriles is known for having a lot of swell and like waves. So I was learning in like pretty big swell, but I remember like there was just no feeling like it. And I remember like really figuring out how to foil, like going my first like one way without touching down and staying dry. And I was like, oh my god, this is what I meant to do. Like, this is it.
That's so cool. Do you remember what gear you had, what foil you used?
Yes, so it was the really old red low aspect Carafino foil. If you remember this, like you're an OG for anyone listening.
I saw it was like pictures. I didn't use it.
It was, oh my god, I can't believe we made that thing work. And then Slingshot had a board at the time. It was like a bamboo board called the Space Pickle, and that's what everyone was learning to foil on at the time. So that was the setup that I learned on. And then I pretty quickly moved to, I think it was like a Sword actually, because there weren't many foils at the time. So you kind of went from like the really low performance, low aspect foils, like straight to kind of the race foils. Cause at that point people were really only like foiling if they were racing. So I went pretty much straight to, I think it was like the Sword 2 at that time. And that was also at the same time as the spots too, that like no one could take a park because it was like breaking at the point where the fuselage and the front wing connect. So, oh my gosh, I remember like being down in La Ventana and so many people were racing on the spots too. And like everyone's like taking their rubber mallets to it, like just trying to whack the thing to get it apart to travel with it. And like, would not budge. So that was a pretty like legendary time in the foiling development.
Now, as you now are a lot better than you were back then, have you ever had the chance, maybe in the last year or 2 years, to use these old foils again? Or do you even have that in your garage? And have you ever used it again? How would that be?
I would be so interested, because I think it's funny because now when people are learning to foil, they like struggle so much and complain so much, and the foils are so good now. I'm like, you have no idea. Like, okay, I'm 24, but like you have no idea how hard it was back in the day. Like, you have no idea. Like, just settle down. But I feel like, I mean, now I feel like I would be okay. Like, I would make it work, but it's just crazy to see how mainstream, in a way, foiling has gone and how much better even the beginner equipment is. So people have no idea nowadays.
But it was so cool to use that old stuff again, or to be able to rent it maybe and see how it was, or get that struggle.
Yeah, I would be so interested in that. Yeah, if anyone has any old gear out there, you know, that they want to send over to me, I'll gladly try it out.
That would make a super cool video as well. But then
yeah,
you got better. You said that you won a world champion title. And when was the time that you thought, all right, this Olympic Games, that's going to be a possibility for you?
Yeah, so I won my first world championships in 2016. I was 15, almost 10 years ago now. Oh my God, so scary.
Wow.
I know. And at the time, like, I was still in high school. Like, I really only considered kiting to be a hobby. I did not see it as like a career path in any sense. And even now, like, it's not really a career path, like realistically, especially for a woman, but that's like a totally different conversation to get into. But I was like, I was just having fun, like doing this hobby on the weekends. And then as the years went on, there were like all these rumors about like kiting being in the Olympics. And I think it was at one point supposed to be in the Olympics, maybe for like 2020 even, but I think it got like taken out because it wasn't going to be foiling or something. And there was all this drama because I think like windsurfing got taken out and kiting swapped in. So there was like, it was already kind of like in the works in a way. And then, yeah, I was kind of like going to all these events and hearing these rumors. And then eventually, yeah, by the end of 2018, it was pretty much confirmed. And I remember like I was still in high school and I was planning to be like, okay, well, I need to go to like university, so maybe I can do a couple of years at university and then like take a couple of years off to train full time or something like that. I had no idea what that, like what training for the Olympics would even look like really. And I didn't know, yeah, because it was just such a different world back then. So it was, yeah. But I remember just like hearing the news and I was like, okay, this is like, this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I'm going to do. So yeah. And we did it, which is pretty crazy and cool.
It is amazing. But there's a lot of work that goes into that. Then you said, all right, I want to try it. And then you probably had to get a team. You need a lot of money. How did that work? How did you manage that?
Yeah, so I kind of around COVID, I got a little bit like burnt out of kiting and racing around COVID. And I was like taking some time away from kiting. And I took that time to kind of spend time with people that were on the US sailing team at the time and campaigning for Tokyo, because then their Olympics got delayed 1 year. So I kind of like learned as much as I could from what they were doing and like what was working, what wasn't, and just like get an idea of what even an Olympic campaign looks like. And then I quickly learned like it's a full-time job. And at the time I was really lucky because like my university classes were online because of the pandemic. I was still kind of able to like, even through 2021, I was able to like travel as we were starting to be able to travel again. I was able to still like do my university classes online and like still train. And like I was spending time in Europe at that point. So I felt like I just started learning what it looks like and what it requires. Yeah, quickly learned like it's a full-time job. And especially in the US, like with the limited resources that we have, we're one of the only countries that where the Olympic Federation and like Olympic sports are not directly funded by the government. So everything is privately funded, and the little funding that we do get from like the Olympic Federation, it's all performance based. So if your sport isn't producing medals, then you're not going to get any money, but you need money in order to produce medals. So it's like it's a catch 22. So it's just, and yeah, we had one medal in Rio, but we came out of Tokyo with zero medals. So the funding for the Olympic sailing team went down significantly. So we were working on like very limited financial resources. And then I was very lucky at that point that I had a lot of results and like achievements by that point. So I had like really amazing brand sponsorships and partnerships like within the industries. The great thing was like I was getting all the gear, and then all I kind of needed was the coaching and support for like logistics, like traveling all the time, travel expenses, accommodations, things like that. So between like the Olympic Federation, what little Olympic Federation funding we got, and then like my private like sponsor contracts, and then additional private fundraising like through contacts in the Bay Area and through like sailing foundations in the US, then that's like how we kind of make everything work in the US. But the crazy thing is like, this is all on you, the athlete, and this is all stuff that you have to figure out. Like there's no book you can read that like tells you how to do this. There's no like university course that you can take that like tells you how to win a medal in sailing at the Olympics. So it's like, you're constantly learning and like juggling all these things. And in the end, you are basically like running a business and you're the CEO and you're making all those final executive decisions. And yes, you can like, you have to form your team around you that kind of helps you make those decisions. But like, you have to figure out your coach and you have to figure out your, like for us, caddies were super important. So you have to figure out like, who's going to work with you, like on the equipment and like be your caddy. And then you have to figure out your like the physio and the nutrition, and like there's all, and then you have to like plan logistics, and like you have to actually be getting the money to do this. So you have to fundraise and be like emailing potential donors and sponsors.
You had a team around you.
Yeah. So that's the thing, like at the beginning, you're doing all these things by yourself, and like, but then you learn like, okay, I have a team that can kind of help me with this, but it's still on you to like figure out how to allocate it and how like what you can take on yourself and what your team can kind of take on. So it's a really, and like it's also very, it's a very personal thing. Like different people do this in different ways. And for example, for me, like I was really lucky that I was able to have a caddy pretty much full time, and he like managed the equipment for me, which was really great because I'm not a very technical person. So for someone to like take on all of that whole job was really good. And then I could focus on like being in contact with like donors and sponsors and things like that. So it's all like, it's a full-time job in the end. And like, it's like running a business. So it teaches you a lot, I think, and you get so much value and experience from it. And even now, like I'm working part-time actually like for a tech startup that's in the Bay Area, and they appreciate that like I've had that experience, and they respect that like I was kind of running a business, and I can take that experience now into the job I have now. So yeah, it's a lot.
That makes a lot of sense. Were you ever, maybe even at the beginning, were you overwhelmed, or do you, when you started thinking like, that's too much, I'm not gonna go through with that? Or was that never an option?
I mean, I was definitely overwhelmed, but I knew it was just like, it's just what you have to do. Like it's the steps you have to take, and it's like these things you have to check off in order to make it to the Olympics and be competing for a medal. So I was like, it's just, it has to be done. And even though I'm overwhelmed, like I have to figure it out because it's just, it's what I have to do. So
a lot of pressure, yeah. Huh?
In a way, yes. But at the same time, I was always enjoying it so much and like enjoying the process so much. And like, I was always super competitive. I loved competing. I loved working hard, and I loved like pushing myself. So in a way, like, it was just the things I needed to do in order to, like, be able to go out and kite every single day, like, as my life, basically, and, like, spend half the year in Europe to train and compete. Like, that was just what I had to do in order to do that. And to me, that was, like, that was the dream, you know?
But so, was there a time where you felt like, all right, I have to go get on the water now because it's kind of my job and it's the ultimate goal going to the Olympics and maybe win a medal? Or did it, was it still fun? Or was it like kind of work and you have to do that?
Oh, absolutely. So I had a really tough year in 2023, actually, where I did get really burnt out and I was not enjoying going on the water at all. And it was tough because there was like this pressure building of like, that was the year I needed to qualify for the Olympics. So I felt like I needed to be like really putting a lot of time in, like putting as much effort in as possible. And it was a really, I got super burnt out and it really felt like a job in a negative way. And I really, like, I would not have gotten through that year, like, without my sports psychologist. Like, I was meeting with her every week, and that really got me through that year because it was just so, so tough. And I was, like, so hard on myself. But yeah, it's like, it is this weird balance of, like, yeah, it's so fun and it is so many people's dreams. And it was my dream growing up, like, to be able to, yeah, go to Europe in the summer, travel around, go kite in all these cool places every single day. Like, that sounds like a dream. But then when, you know, that becomes your job, there's this like different perspective put on it. And I had so many, I went through months of like, I would wake up in the morning and my first thoughts would be like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to put my wetsuit on. I don't want to go on the water. And like it was so draining. And I ended up having to take like so many months off that winter because I was just so burnt out. Like, 1 year before the Olympics, like, you're like, oh, that's great. Like, now's the time I should be like putting time in and being on the water a lot. But I just had to like trust my gut and take that time off. So yeah, it's given me a lot of experience and perspective on how I want to like do this campaign now and like how I want to train for LA 2028. Because now I know, for example, like it is not sustainable for me to be like traveling so much and like living out of my board bags all year. Like in 2023, for example, I spent 2 weeks at like home, quote unquote. Like, that's not sustainable. Like, I can't do that anymore. Like, yes, I'm 24, but I'm too old for that. Yeah. I can't.
It's so cool that you have these experiences now.
Yeah. But I was like, I can't do that anymore. Like, I want to have a home and I want to be able to like have things and like somewhere to go back to. So, for like, that was something really important for me starting this year. Like, I really wanted to actually have a home somewhere. So that was why I really moved down to LA. And like, I have my apartment here. I have my doggy here. Like, even now, next or in a couple weeks now, we'll be racing here at the Olympic venue. And like, to be able to sleep in my own bed and be at home actually and like have my dog here and still be racing, like, that is incredible. Like, I'm so grateful for that. So, but I wouldn't have learned that if I hadn't gone through all of that experience. So, yeah.
That's good. How was the competition then to qualify for the actual Olympics? Was that close? Was there one other woman or were there a few that were, was close? How was that?
Yeah, so basically for the Olympics, it's the top 20 countries in the world and it's one athlete per country. And the host country automatically gets a spot. And then it's kind of regional, like Europe has their own qualification. And then North and South America have like Pan Am Games is kind of our qualification event, and so on. So for me, I basically in 2023, I needed to be top three at the Olympic test event in Marseille, which was in like July of 2023. And then I needed to be top 10 at the World Championships. And there were a couple like domestic events before that, which I needed to be the best American at in order to qualify for the test event and for World Championships. So it was kind of this like long process that was pretty much like all of 2023. Yeah, basically once I knew I was probably the best American, like after those early 2023 events, then I was like, okay, everything was all about being top three at the test event and then top 10 at Worlds. And then I mean, having the track record that I had of having 6 world titles at that point, I was pretty confident I would be top 10 at the Worlds. The big like peak focus was on being top 3 in Marseille at the Olympic venue, actually. And I finished 3rd there. So after that, I was like, okay, like I can breathe a little bit. Like the biggest hurdle has passed. So yeah.
Then Marseille is usually a spot with good winds, but during the Olympics, when I remember the videos, it was not super windy, or was it?
Yeah, so we got really unlucky with the conditions, which was just such a bummer. So I was in Marseille starting the beginning of June, and pretty much all of June and July, we could have kited almost every single day. Like, it was unreal conditions. And then, of course, as soon as we're supposed to start racing for the Olympics, the weather pattern completely changed at the beginning of August, and we just had, like, no wind. Normally, for reference, we have, like, 20-plus races in our qualifying series at a normal regatta, and at the Olympics, we only had 6. So that just tells you, like, how little racing we got. I don't think I've ever, like, in my 10 years now of racing Formula Kite, I've never been at a regatta where we've raced so little. So that was like so crazy and like so frustrating on so many levels. But yeah, it was just so tough because obviously it's the first time the sport is at the Olympics. You want to like show the world how cool it is and like share it with the world, and to like not be able to like perform at your best or like have the opportunity to like showcase your skills and just share your sport with the world. To not even have the opportunity to do that because of just like being unlucky with the weather and something that's completely out of your control is so frustrating. So yeah, but that's
what it is. Yeah, nothing you can do about it, really. But if you know that usually the wind is really good there, then it's even a little worse. Maybe you can just, for the listeners, give us a few facts. How big is the kite? How long are the lines? What kind of foil were you using? And that board has some volume, but do you really need it?
Yeah, so basically the equipment it's pretty specific. Basically, we're riding foils that have like 100 plus centimeter long masts. I think the longest one is around like 114 cm. That's the Levitas. And I think the Chubanga is around like 105, 104, something like that. So super long masts. The front wings themselves, I think, are around like 600, 500 maybe even. So it's like super, super tiny little front wing. And very high aspect as well. And then how it works is we can have 4 kites registered for a regatta. The biggest at the time, the last 4 years or the last several years, the biggest was 21, usually for the women, 23 for the men. The women could have been on a 23, but most of us were too small to be able to manage the power of the 23. And then the second kite is the 15, then 11 and 9. And our line lengths are super short. I think most people are running from like 10 to 15 meter long lines. 10 is like pretty, a little short, but like relatively normal. And then 15 meter lines would be like for really, really light and sketchy days to use with the big kites. And now a recent development with the equipment is that we now only have 3 kite sizes. And for the women, it's 9, 11, 15. And that was in an effort to bring the weight of the class down, like the body weight needed to be competitive down. And for the men, I think the biggest kite is 9.
Okay. So. And you have shorter lines, so it's more agile, so you can like make maneuvers more quickly.
Yeah, it just gives you like more control and responsiveness. And when you think about like doing maneuvers, if you have really long lines, then like the time it takes, because it's a bigger distance to like actually go around the whole wind window, maneuvers are way quicker. But you also just have like a way more direct feel for the kite. So it's like a few of these different things.
And you got, we mentioned it, I'm sorry, I have to repeat it. You got 4th, which is amazing, which is really good. But obviously you want to be on that podium, want to get a medal. When you look back now, if there would have been more races, do you think that you would have improved a little more and got on the podium?
So it's tough to say because I was 3rd, or at least tied for bronze going into the final race. And then basically, there's a lot of controversy around what happened in my medal race, but basically there were some very questionable decisions made by the umpires is all I'm gonna say, basically. There were some very questionable decisions made, which basically resulted in me finishing fourth. And of course, based on like the facts that I know and based on the broadcast footage, I really believe that I should have been third. And so the whole process of that was like, it was so crazy. And the way it all went down was really crazy. And I have a video like talking through all of that up on my Instagram if like people are interested in listening to it. And I've written about it on my website as well, because I felt like I needed to tell that story. But basically, yeah, it was like just so heartbreaking, because you like put so much time and like effort and resources, and like the people around you, like your family and your friends and your whole team, like they put so much effort into this. And to like, for that final result to be like affected by something that's completely out of your control, and by people that were in a room on shore, like watching drone footage and making decisions, and for those decisions, like for them not to bring the same level of professionalism to their job as you do to yours, is like extremely disappointing. It sucks because you like, you just put your whole life into this and you put everything on the line, and for them not to bring that same effort into their job is really disappointing. So it was like, it was really heartbreaking, because in the end, like, I truly believe, like, if I were to sail that medal race again, I would have done the exact same thing, because I know I did everything right. And for that to have resulted in fourth place and not third is like, it's brutal. It was just one of the things, like, now I think about it, I've always been like, I know I did all the right things. Like, if I were to do it again, I would have done the exact same thing, because I know I did everything right. And of course, like, when I, obviously people like ask about it, and some people are like, oh my God, fourth, that's amazing. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, it is, like, I finished fourth at the Olympics, that's super cool. But I also, like, deep down, I feel like I should have been third, and I like should have gotten a bronze. It's tough, because then, yeah, you like, you just miss out on the podium, and you get like so, so close. And then for me, it felt like it got taken away by decisions that umpires made, basically.
Yeah,
so it's super tough.
I'm not sure what is worse, if you get fourth and could have been third, or if you got second and could have been first. It's like these two steps is so hard. So that's terrible. But then, are you even more hungry now for LA? Like, get revenge or something?
In a way, like, I feel like in a lot of ways, I'm still like recovering from everything that happened, because it was a really long campaign in a way, because like, even I felt like this was, even though I wasn't truly full time competing and like full time training, I felt like I was working, and like this was kind of my job for so long that I feel like I'm still needing a break from all of it. So that's why even starting this year, like, I wasn't ready to go back to being a full-time athlete. And some days I wake up and I'm like, let's like, excuse my French, but like, let's fuck shit up, you know? Like, sometimes I wake up like that and I'm like, yeah, let's go. But other days I'm like, like I'm really comfortable right now. Like, I have stability, a job right now, and I'm making, like, I have a steady income that, you know, like, at least it covers my rent, you know, like, and I'm appreciating that feeling of like normalcy and having more of like a normal life, quote unquote. But yeah, so I feel like I definitely still have that fire, and like, I do want revenge, and I still have like unfinished business basically in this sport and like in this class. But at the same time, I'm taking the experience that I've gained like from the last several years, and I feel like I'm applying it in a way that will make this more like, just this campaign more sustainable and like fun for me and just enjoyable overall. So it's like, yes, like, I'm super fired up in some ways, but I'm going at my own pace that I think makes sense for me, and that I know will be like, will lead to success for me. So,
and it can, as you say, it can also be, you can also feel lighter going into that competition with all that you know now, and maybe be a little more relaxed. I want to get into, because I saw on your Instagram that you have other like the pictures as well that you are on boats. I saw you on a Wasp, I saw on a GC32. So I'm sure that you are on foil all the time, but you weren't on the Women's America's Cup, were you?
No, I wasn't. So yeah, kind of over the last several years, I got to like dabble in a bit of sailing. I got to like, I was doing CLGP for a little bit, which was really cool back when Jimmy was driving the US team. And then like with that, yeah, I got to do a bit of Wasp sailing, Moth sailing. I was like initially kind of in the first pool of women that were maybe going to be selected for the American, for like the American Magic women's team, which was the Women's America's Cup team from the US. Didn't play the political game well enough, I would say, to kind of make my way to do that, but I'll just leave it at that. But yeah, I feel like I've been like really lucky to get all this like experience like that. And it's because of like kiting, and it's because of what I've done in kiting, I've like gotten to like have opportunities in these other sports. And for a long time, I was like, oh my gosh, like I want to do this forever. Like, I just want to keep like foiling and kiting and sailing and like just doing whatever I can in the water forever. But now I'm like, I don't know. I've gone through this like weird phase, especially like just since the Olympics. And I've just, the more I've seen like how the sailing world especially can like treat women, because it is like, it's still a male dominated sport. And even with like, even with kiting and even with like foiling and winging and whatever it is now, like they're all still male dominated sports. And there's so few opportunities to make it a like career, whatever we want to say is like a career, even for like for men to begin with, and even fewer for women. So it's so hard to like imagine yourself long term being able to do that. And especially like being from a country like the US where like the cost of living right now especially like is just ridiculous. Like I can't just like kite for a living. Like I was barely breaking even the last like 10 years, and I was getting a ton of help from my parents and stuff. So like my parents were super supportive, and I was like so lucky to have all of these resources basically to help me do this. But like long term, like I want to be independent, and like trying to be a pro sailor, kiteboarder, foiler, and maybe I don't want to live in the US forever, like especially the way things are right now. Like maybe I want to go to Europe eventually, but like I don't know, like it's not a sustainable career. And like what if I want to have kids later? Like I can't just live off of like a like contract like salary, whatever those are now, I don't know. So it's just like, it's a really interesting thing, and this is coming from like someone that has had really great results, and like I would say at least, and like nice. Been really lucky with like, yeah, with my parents' support and with like having good connections. And like in the US we have these like foundations that help sailors do these things. So like this is coming from someone that has had really great support. And if I don't see myself like doing this long term, then like it's really, really hard. So I don't know. Now I'm definitely kind of
for kids, especially girls getting into that sport.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly. And it's hard in that way, because I do want to show girls that like it is possible to do this, and that like they can do it as well as the boys, if not better in a way. But I also like lately I've tried to really be like more realistic and have more of that balance, I think, because like the fact is like you can't make a long-term living out of this. And I think that's something like they need to be aware of in a way. And I think that's like I don't think it's healthy to like glamorize it so much, because and make it look like it's all this like perfect world. Like, because even take CLGP, for example, like unless you're winning events all the time, like you're not, as a woman, like you're not making a living from that. So it's like, so I don't know like what these women are doing or like what people are doing, but it's like, it's very, very hard to like live off of sailing as a woman. And when I say sailing, I also kind of include like kiting and winging and foiling in that. So it's, yeah. And I think like, even it's hard because I felt like I really needed to continue university and like go back to school after the Olympics and finish my degree, because I knew like in order to have a job and like a backup plan, like I need to have that degree. Whereas there's a lot of the guys that are like in Olympic sailing that a lot of them like didn't finish school, or they like I don't know, that wasn't as, that didn't need to be a priority for them because they could fall back on like pro sailing. And so then it's like, it becomes a domino effect because, okay, well, if I know I can't really like make a living from pro sailing and those like opportunities won't be there, then I need the fallback plan, which takes time away from potentially having the like opportunities. So it's like, it's a really weird dynamic. So yeah, I don't know. It's like, on one hand, I do want to encourage like young girls to get into these sports, because I think like you learn so much like about yourself, about the world, like you learn to respect nature and like you learn all these things and it's so beneficial. But at the same time, like I'm hesitant to like to encourage that to become your entire life, I guess, if that makes sense, because there are like so many other things out there. So yeah, it's an interesting dynamic and something I never thought I would really see before. And now that I've like gotten a bit older and like gotten this perspective, I'm like, huh, it's like, that's just the reality.
Being
it's
how realistic it is. With them, not just, glamorize. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So
that, thank you very much for that. That's super interesting. I want to get into your Instagram. And honestly, the first time I saw one of your videos was the one where you roasted foil brands or people using these foil brands. And that's hilarious. And then I watched all the kite brands as well. It was super fun. How did you come up with that? Was that your idea? And was that just off the top? Because you obviously have been in this area for a while now and you know everything already. Or do you have to do some research as well? How was that?
Yeah, so the reason I originally came up with this is I was actually like kind of going through this phase of feeling quite like cynical about like the whole kiteboarding industry and stuff and like the foiling industry. And I don't know, I felt like I was seeing all this content on social media that was like, I was like, you guys are taking this way too seriously. Like, you're not curing cancer. Like, you're not saving the world from climate change, you know, like take a step back. Like, come on. So then I was like, huh, how has like no one, and then I started thinking, I had this like idea randomly. I was like, huh, like what your kite brand says about you, that would be a really interesting like video. And so I started thinking about like what, like the very stereotypical, like I started like some of the main brands that we all know like in kiting. And I started thinking about like the various, very stereotypical like riders or like the people that ride those brands. So I kind of had like a skeleton of an idea. And then I was like, okay, well, if this does well, then I could do like what your foil brand says about you. And then I still have like a couple other ideas that I think would be funny. And I'm still working on like later parts to this series that is doing very well on social media right now. So yeah, so then I was like, okay, like this is what your kite brand says about you. And I try to like, I feel like I'm not naturally a very like funny person. Like I'm not a very sarcastic person.
That was
like I'm
hilarious,
pretty...
honestly.
So I really had to script all of it out, honestly, but it took a lot of time for me to think about like, okay, this is like, yeah, if you ride Slingshot, like you're from Hood River, like the only people that ride Slingshot are from Hood River. And then like the core one, I felt like was all the typical, like the Germans, like they don't want to have fun. They take it so seriously. Like, I know, I started thinking, and then as I like had these ideas, I would think of more things. And then, yeah. And then, so that was like what your kite brand says about you. And then I was like, okay, I was actually really surprised at how well it did. Like it was one of my best performing videos was like what your kite brand says about you, part one. I think now it has like over 100,000 views on Instagram, so which is super crazy. So if you haven't seen it yet, check it out. You're missing out. You should check your algorithm, because if you're not getting that, then I don't know what you're getting if you kite. But yeah, so then I was like, okay, I need to do this for what your foil brand says about you, because that would be like so funny. It was very niche, so I was like, okay, it's not gonna perform as well, but it'll be like really funny for the people that know. And then yeah, I think my favorite one so far has been what your foil brand says about you, part two. I like, it's gonna be so hard to top that one.
Was that the one with the axis, or was that the part one?
That was the one. Part one was with axis, go foil, and a couple others I'm like blanking now. But then part two had Armstrong. Was like one of my favorite, that was one of my favorite comments. And then I put Mike's Lab, and oh my gosh, there was one more. I've like drafted so many of these now that I like lose track of which one was which. But Yeah, it was pretty funny. I was F1 was in part two. That was the other one.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so
Okay.
I felt like, yeah, that was some of my best work. And it's hilarious because like these videos have done so well, and my like very like thoughtful, like well-edited videos from like training for the Olympics and like being at the Olympics did like okay. And I was like, yeah, this is social media. Like this is it. And now I feel like so many people have followed me like for that and like probably didn't even know who I was until then, which is fine. So I mean, I'm happy for the ego check, but it keeps me humble. Yeah. So
You know, it's not
anyways.
only what you say, also the way you said it.
I
It's
know.
really, it's so cool the way you deliver these things. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And
So
I
if you
really
haven't
hope
seen
that
those,
you keep
check
on
them
going
out.
with the foil brand. Yeah, so we're gonna link your Insta here somewhere anyway. Yeah, you definitely have to check that out. It's hilarious. So you're ready for other brands as well?
Yeah, so I'm working on part four of what your Kite brand says about you, which will have some of the more like niche brands, I'll say. Don't want to spoil anything yet. And then I'm working on part three of what your foil brand says about you. But
Yes.
like, it's so hard because part two of what your foil brand says about you was so good. Like, I don't know. I thought it was hilarious.
It is
It was actually really
100%.
hard to I thought it was really hard to record because it took me a while to like stop laughing at some of those jokes, you know? So yeah, I'm probably not gonna get any more sponsorships out of these videos, but it was funny the like the brand the North like kiteboarding brand manager like started following me after that, and then like Pete Cabrina commented on one of the videos. So it's funny. It's been like cool to see that like some of these, even like Kelly Slater and Austin Keane liked one of the videos. So that
Nice.
was really cool. So I'm
I mean,
glad
it's an
it's
honor for a
entertaining
brand
people.
if they get roasted, so they are relevant, really. That's a good thing, I'd say.
Yeah. So it's been fun to make those. It's been something different. Yeah.
But you said that sometimes it was a little bit too much water sport, maybe too much foiling. Did you do wing foiling as well? Did you try the parawing? I saw you surf foiling as well. Did you try dock starting, pump foiling? What did you do?
Yeah, so kind of when I was taking a break during the pandemic, I got into winging a bit, especially like even now, like I love winging in waves, but I will only go winging if it's like over 20 knots and I can go in waves. Like I'm a snob like that. Like I'm not gonna go in light wind with a huge board. Like I want to use my 28 liter board and just like send it down some waves. So that's like the only way I'll wing now, because otherwise I just get bored. And then so yeah, so did it like really got into winging during the pandemic. And then I was finishing up university in Hawaii, actually, which was obviously super fun. And I was living on Oahu from January through May of this year. And I had like learned to prone surf foil like during COVID, actually, like during my kiting break during COVID. But then I hadn't proned in like years, basically like since then. So I got back into prone in Hawaii. And right now that's the thing that I'm like absolutely obsessed with right now is like prone surf foiling. It's so fun. And I don't know, everyone's like so into the downwinding right now, like, which is fun. I get the appeal of it. But I just like coming from kiting, like we have these tiny boards and like I don't want to have to deal with like a massive board that's like bigger than me. Like that doesn't make any sense for me. So I'm like really into the surfing right now, and I'm really lucky that I live like just down the street from a really awesome surf foiling spot in LA. Yeah, so that's been my addiction lately. And I ride KT, by the way. KT will be coming in. I was riding Lyft, I'll admit that. I was using the Lyft 120 and the 150, and now I've just switched to KT. Not sponsored. If they want to sponsor me, let me know, but
They should.
maybe I should get the contract before I post a
Before
ghosting
you release
video.
the video, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so anyways, so I surf on the KT, which I really love, and yeah, so that's been it.
Have you tried the Parawing?
Not yet. I'm hoping to try it. Well, I might go up to Hood River at the end of the month with my
Nice.
parents for a little fun trip. So I might try it there. But that's the thing with the parawing, like you need a big board, and I'm really anti big board right
Yeah,
now.
compared to
So
kiting, you need a big board, but compared to downwind subfoiling, you don't need a big board.
yeah, I know. If it's I would like to try to paroing like on a tiny board in Hood River. I feel like I might be able to. I don't know. I haven't like tried the paroing at all, so I don't know if it would work. But it seems like people are using it on like some quite small boards. I don't think I've seen anyone using it on anything that's under like 40 liters, probably. That's probably the smallest paroing I've seen.
On the weekend, he subfoiled, he flat water started a 44 liter board, and he's like 65 kilos.
That's impressive.
It is super impressive. So they're probably people going with really sinkers on the paroing. But usually, yes, it's easier to get up on a little bigger board, I'd say. But I think it's super.
Yeah.
Plus, if you live near Hood River, oh, that's probably the place to go. Have you been there before?
Yes, I have. I'm from the Bay Area. So it's like a 12-hour drive up north. But my parents used to go all the time for windsurfing. And then I've gone a couple times, like the last 5 years. We'll see if I make it up there this summer again. It's a super cool place. And now it's just like going off with all of the downwinding, which is cool. Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice. I'm sure you can use some parawings when you're up there. I saw you did a triathlon as well, the Alcatraz triathlon.
Yeah, I did. I got into, after the Olympics, everyone had to be like as heavy as possible for the Olympics. And so we were all like putting on weight as much as possible. In the lead up to the Olympics. So I was like not feeling good in my body. I was like the heaviest I'd ever been. And like, I was strong, like I was lifting a lot of weight in the gym, but I just like felt bloated, like felt chubby, didn't feel good. And then and I grew up swimming. So I was like, I grew up doing like an endurance sport. And so I was like, okay, after the Olympics, I want to like get back into swimming. I want to get like into cycling because a lot of like the sailors and my boyfriend is really into cycling. So I was like, okay, I want to get back into these things. And then I was thinking, I was like, you know, well, if I'm going to like swim and bike, like I kind of might as well just like do a triathlon. My boyfriend had done an Ironman 70.3 like in the year before in 2023. So I was like, well, if he can do it, like I can do it.
That's always the way to go.
I was like, okay,
of course you were
it,
able
like,
to do it if you were a swimmer.
Yeah. So then I signed up for an Ironman 70.3, which was in December of 2024. So I did that, and that was, it was fun. It's a special type of fun. I mean, like if you say like doing that much effort and endurance and like suffering and you say that's fun, like there's something wrong with you, but it's type two fun, whatever. But it was fun. I enjoyed it. Like I really love biking. I still love swimming. And now, yeah. And then, so I did that. And then I saw that there was the Escape from Alcatraz in June. And obviously that being at home and like such an iconic venue, I was like, oh, it would be so cool to do that. So I was training for it a lot at the beginning of this year, like when I was in university in Hawaii. But then kind of by like March, I was just getting so addicted to surfing that was like all I was doing. So basically from like
swimming,
March, exactly. And honestly, like with all the paddling and the pumping, like my cardio got pretty good. And so I basically like did not run, bike or swim like from March until June, which was like, okay, yeah, that's really smart, Daniela. And then I was like, okay, I'm just gonna like do this triathlon cold turkey. And I was like surprised at how I like felt pretty fit actually. And I took it. The swim was super cold.
How long was
and
it?
Like a ton of current. The swim is 1.6 miles. So I think it's like 2.6 Ks. So the swim is pretty long and it's free. Like the water was super cold.
San Francisco is terrible. Yeah.
And a ton of current. So it was like, it was a pretty crazy swim. And I have never swam so fast in my life. Like I could not see my hand in front of me. I kept thinking about sharks because I've like seen sharks like kiting there and stuff. And I've never swam so fast in my life. So that was one of my fastest swims ever. And then during the bike, I kind of chilled. I was like, oh, it's such a nice bike
ride. Was it a hilly
ride?
Because San Francisco has a lot of hills.
Yes, it was super hilly. I think there
were...
It was like 600 meters of elevation, I think. So not too bad, but like it was pretty up and down. But it was a really nice bike ride, and I was like just like admiring the view, and like everybody's on their like triathlon, like time trial bikes, like sending it down the hills and stuff, like in the elbow things. So I'm just like chilling. I was like, oh, this is great. I'm just doing it like for the vibes, you know, because that's what people do for fun. They do triathlons, I guess. They like to make themselves suffer for fun. But yeah. And then so I finished the bike ride. The bike ride was like 18 miles. So like relatively short bike ride. So I think it's like around 30K or so 30K, for the bike ride. So. Yeah. And then the run, I was like, I was ready to die on the run. I was like, I might not make it home, you know, but I survived. I felt pretty good. All the surfing paid off here, really. I could feel like my legs were pretty good. There was also a lot of elevation and part of it was on the beach. So fun. And yeah, but I survived and I managed to, like, my pace wasn't even that bad. I managed to stay like under 10 minute per mile, which I don't know how many, what that would be for kilometers. Yeah. So I was like, okay, yeah, that I want to say it's around like 6 minutes per K maybe. That seems a little bit.
Yeah.
But like with all the elevation, I was like, okay, that's not too bad. And having not ran in like the months leading up to that, I was like, okay, I'll take that. So yeah, it was like just one of those things. I just wanted to do it and finish it. So yeah, it was fun. I'm glad I finished and I did it once.
And the finish is always better if it was a little bit of suffering.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing. Like it's fun afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
Like.
That's true.
I wouldn't say it's fun during, it's fun in a way during it, but it's more fun afterwards. So yeah.
I did two like half Ironmans and one like regular one. And I remember the swimming was easy because you can just float basically and you get there.
Yeah.
And with the bike ride as well, you can sometimes like go down the hill and you can relax a little bit. But if you relax running, then you just stop. So that doesn't really work.
Exactly. Yeah.
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 But yeah, I'm done with that as well. And I'm back on the water, really. That's good. Listen, we're way over an hour already. I just want to quickly hear or listen to some stories because you've foiled and you've kited so much. I'm sure there are some dangerous or crazy stories that you had. You said you surfed next to sharks. I don't know. Do you have any crazy stories that people need to hear, that I need to hear?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. I think, honestly, like, in a way, the craziest thing I would always do is when I was still, like, in high school and, like, when I was living in San Francisco, or, like, just outside of San Francisco, and I would sometimes go, like, on the weekends out to Chrissy, and I would sometimes go by myself out on the water, and there's a rock. Well, it used to be a former lighthouse that's 1 mile outside the Golden Gate Bridge. And I would just like go send it around. It's called Mile Rock. And I would just like go out by myself and send it around Mile Rock. And now, like, looking back, I wouldn't tell my parents I did that until after, obviously. My mom is always like, don't go too far outside the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, what mom, like, tells her 17-year-old, 18-year-old daughter, like,
sense.
That? Like,
you know, she's right.
Like, yes. But, of course, me being me, I'm like, oh, I got it, no problem. Like, I'll just do a few laps around Mile Rock as per usual. But, yeah, I feel like those were, like, there were some pretty crazy days where I was like, oh my god, if something happens, like if something breaks, I don't know, then like there's always stories of like people spending the night like getting flushed out the Golden Gate and then coming back like with the flood, like when the tide changes, and spending the night out there. So there's always like there's one story like that every year, I would say. So yeah, I feel like those were like those crazy missions, like going by myself around Mile Rock. That was probably without a phone or anything too, just like sending it out there. That was a little crazy. So yeah,
that sounds crazy. But you never had like a twisting up kites when going full speed, or foils breaking because you ran into a log or something?
I mean, I've definitely had a few like tangles and stuff. I think one of my most memorable tangles was at the 2024 World Championships in here. We just had like a huge pile up at the top mark and like 10 kites are all like tangled up and like went in the water. Like there were, it was just like one of those where like one person like wasn't making the top mark but like tried to, and then the next person like tack inside wasn't making it, and it just like it was this train and it was this huge pile up. So I've definitely had a couple of those where it's just like just chaos, but I thrive in that, you know, like we make it work. So
Because for me, that's really crazy. If I see you kiters and the kite so far away and going so close to each other, and I, as a sailor, everything is pretty close to myself and my little boat here, everything's good. But here, that's so different. Even that you see where the kite's going to go through, that's crazy for me. To me, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
Really impressive.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun. It's definitely fun. Exciting. Yeah.
All right, Daniela, thank you very much for taking your time. Really, is there anything else you want to tell our listeners or viewers?
I don't think so. If you made it this far, glad you were able to listen to me just yap about my life and stuff. But thanks so much for listening, and definitely follow along in The Life of Daniela. That's my username on Instagram. Watch out for part 4 of what your kite brand says about you and part 3 of what your foil brand says about you. And of course, like me trying to like qualify for the LA 2020 Olympics, like in case you're interested in that. So I know you're just here for the entertainment, but yeah, so thanks for having me. It was super fun. And yeah, probably see you out on the water somewhere.
That will be super cool. And for all the listeners, viewers, just a little heads up. Next episode is going to be with Gav Hydrofoil. He's a sup downwinder. He's a parawinger. He's probably next to Dan, the parawing expert. He tests all these different parawings, and he's a rescue helicopter pilot, I think. So super exciting.
Wow.
Things. I'm looking forward to that. And again, Daniela, thank you much for coming on the show. If you want to listen to all your episodes, up on foil.com, that's the website. And I think you have to go run with your dog.
Yeah, she just decided to get active. I'm glad it was at the end here.
Perfect. All right, Daniela, yeah. Thank you so much. And yeah, I hope to see you on the water, really. And good luck for the
thank
Olympics.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Bye. I appreciate it. Bye.